Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Tim Murphy, senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, joins me to discuss the peculiar evolution of Senator Kyrsten Sinema's politics. From Green Party activist to radical centrist obstructionist, her career is anything but traditional.
Ryan Grimm, Washington correspondent for The Intercept and new co-host of The Hills Rising, will be joining me as Heather Parton is on vacation. Ryan and I will be looking back on the week in politics. And don't forget, if you want to become a member of this program and support this program, you can do so over at ROFpodcast.com. When you do, like I say, you not only support the show, you also get extra content. This week, I speak with Ellie Mistal, the justice correspondent for The Nation magazine, writing about a fascinating dilemma where you have inner city defense lawyers writing an amicus brief on a case to get rid of gun control in New York State. It's a fascinating discussion of gun control and the issues and strategies that different parties are taking. And you get all of that by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. And when you do, of course, you can look back into our archives for all the member content you missed. So become a member today. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. So Heather Parton is on vacation this week, usually on Fridays. We look back on the week in our politics. Instead, joining me is the Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept and also the host of the newly minted host of The Rising on for The Hill. Ryan Grimm, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
We've had quite a week again in politics, which I don't. There's a lot of drama, I guess, for the month of July, beginning of August. Let's start, obviously, what's going on right now with the pandemic. There has been a dramatic over the past 4 weeks, really, growth in infections around the country, particularly in states that are under vaccinated. Essentially, I think we reached 70% sometime, I think, this week or the end of last week. But I suspect that we have parts of the country that are closer to 80% and other parts of the country that are closer to 45%. And those 45% countries tend to be red states. Some of it is a function of Republicans, you know, owning the libs by not getting a vaccine, or really just frankly getting disinformation from their media ecosphere, I guess. And some, I think, there's still people who don't have access and are maybe the threshold has been reached. On Wednesday and Thursday of this week, we had record highs of vaccinations that we haven't seen in really, frankly, months. And today, I imagine we're going to set more records, at least for the past couple of months. And then we have Republican governors who are lamenting the fact that they signed anti-masking mandates. Just give me your sense of what's happening here. And are we, I mean, obviously, first order issue is, are we going to be able to get people vaccinated and save people's lives? But the other is, you know, is there going to be any accounting for this?
Well, people do seem to be responding to the pressure of reality. You know, I think, you know, in the beginning, people said, look, you know, if after a few months, a lot of these people who are hesitant and skeptical of the vaccines have seen people in their social circle get the vaccine and be okay, and seeing other people in their social circle not get the vaccine and not be okay, then they're going to be much more likely to get it. And that's what anybody who's living in this country has seen in their circles. I wonder what would happen if we said, look, fine, get it or don't get it. The whole world needs this vaccine. You got 45 days to get it. And then we're shipping everything to Mexico or, you know, right. And hey, if you don't want it, fine. I think you'd see a massive rush. People are like, oh, wait, what? It's not going to be there forever for us to get. Yeah, I better get this. But I do think you're seeing the result of people interacting with reality rather than what you said, the kind of ecosphere of their media diet.
I'm also really curious as to what the implications of Asa Hutchinson coming up there as governor of Arkansas and saying, I made a mistake when I signed this legislation 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, look, there's a similar dynamic a little bit, I think, with the Biden administration insofar as there was pressure to sort of like put up a mission accomplished banner in some respects and get the CDC to revoke the mask mandate. They did so just as the Delta variant.
Just as it's coming in.
I mean, honestly, and I imagine that was a coincidence in terms of the timing, but not necessarily unrelated to the steep curve of the Delta infections. I mean, we know masks inhibit the contagiousness, and Delta is that much more contagious. We also know there's a lot more like N95s and KN95 right. masks available that are far more effective, which is not to say that cloth masks aren't effective, but the fact is an N95 mask
much better. Yeah.
If two of us are in the same room, according to Michael Osterholm, if two of us are in the same room and we both have N95 masks, we can stay in there for a day right. Without transferring the disease. And so that's pretty powerful stuff. Obviously, it diminishes if one doesn't right. have a mask. But what do you think the implications of that are going to be with Asa Hutchinson? Because DeSantis right. is in a similar jam, but he's ignoring it.
He is ignoring it. I mean, so for Asa Hutchinson, he doesn't really have presidential ambitions. So, you know, he has a slightly different calculation. And all of these governors have, you know, authority over hospitals, and they have people who report back to them on the conditions in the hospitals. And there are real crisis conditions going on. You know, in Florida, you're seeing reports of people being turned away because of packed hospitals. And so, you know, when that is filtering up to the governor, that's real life, because now you're not just talking about, the health implications of COVID, but anybody who needs hospital services now has to start wondering, like, wait a minute, if I go in to get my treatment that I'm scheduled for, am I going to be able to? What situation am I going to find there? And that all becomes political. You know, DeSantis is still running on the fumes of the media describing him as having won the pandemic.
Right.
And he just wants to like close his eyes and cover his ears and wake up at a time where he had still won the pandemic. He'd rather not be in a time where Florida has like more than half of all the cases in the entire country and its hospitals are, you know, bursting at the seams. So at some point, like we were talking earlier about reality is going to intervene and he's going to have to do something.
I really do get the sense that he is hoping, and we should say that, and there's no guarantee here, but what we saw in England and to some extent in India, there just hits a point where all of a sudden, and in ways that scientists don't quite understand, in the past, it hits like a peak and then it just drops precipitously. Right. It hits some right. type of critical mass.
It's hard for us to understand exponential growth as humans, and yes. it's hard for us to understand exponential decline also. But that is the great hope.
That's what DeSantis is hoping, that it
will burn through. Like it's what Trump was saying in like March 2000. This is just going to burn through. It'll die out. Whereas with Delta, it is so contagious that, and it moves so fast that we have seen it in the past. And he's hoping, look, if I can just make it through 4 to 6 weeks of this, but thousands and thousands of people will not make it through those 4 to 6 weeks.
And like you say, I mean, we don't hear this anymore, but this is what we heard for like 3 or 4 months solid, bend the curve.
Right.
And because of the velocity in which this transmits, that becomes more crucial than it was even during the right. first surge of the wild type of COVID. And yet, you never hear that term anymore,
right?
Because, like, you know, we're like you say, the issue at this point is you will not have as many deaths, but you will have a lot of hospitalizations, And you will have long-term implications, but you also, you could break your medical system
right
in a state, like literally just break it. I mean,
which you're going to need for the next wave.
Exactly. Exactly. And,
if, so, you know, if there is one, which doesn't seem impossible by any stretch.
Right. Well, there's a reason why they're using the Greek alphabet. Right.
Right.
And it's not just because they wanted the first four letters.
Right.
And I think that is the, you know, that is the concern that people have. All right, let's turn to the implications of the pandemic. There's been all sorts of data. It's been fascinating that we have cut poverty in this country by half, which of course begs the question of like, well, wait a second. If we can do half, why don't we do whole, frankly? But with that said, we have sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity to say like, we just did a pilot program. And that pilot program cut poverty in half. It cut extreme poverty dramatically. It cut poverty for children dramatically. And I'm trying to pivot into the eviction moratorium thing, but before we even get there, it's like we don't see any sort of reckoning with this. It's amazing to me how little this is trumpeted. Mm-hmm. It's as if like, you know, it's like, well, we did that, but that was, let's not count on. I mean, it comes out page A15 or whatever it is in the paper. You know, I don't know if anybody actually reads the paper anymore, but like that. But what do you make of that? I mean, how is there not a constituency or a politician who thinks like, hey, this could be helpful to me?
Right. I mean, I think it means that we care as much about having reduced poverty or reducing poverty as we care about poverty, you know, which is not at all. That's just kind of what our political system is about. It's, you know, practically a miracle that they even bothered to do it in the first place. And now in the background, they're pushing to extend this, you know, through to 2025. All signs are that they're going to successfully accomplish this, at which point it's very difficult to see it, to see that repealed.
You're talking about the child tax credit,
which is in particular the element that is credited with reducing, you know, poverty and particularly child poverty by half. And so you're seeing, we're in an amazing moment where we've already had $2 trillion in new spending on top of what Trump did. And now you have $4 trillion in spending kicking around, and it's just not being talked about. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
And Democrats should take that to heart and be like, you know what? We can do whatever we want on the spending front now, like at this moment. Like, and it's not, it, you know, the Rahm Emanuel thing, we can't do anything with a T. Well, how about six Ts?
It is such a unique time in that respect. I mean, McConnell came out, I think it was yesterday or the day before, saying something to the effect of like, yeah, we're not helping the Democrats raise the debt limit. And it just occurred to me like, no, but nobody cares.
Who cares?
Like, do it in reconciliation. Nobody cares. This is not a controversial thing anymore. Like played out the Republican Party. There is no Paul Ryan to who the media seems to sort of like accept that they are actually being truthful about this. There's just, they don't even make an effort anymore. The Republicans still operating under a platform that says we support Donald Trump. I mean, literally.
Right.
And the Democrats, you know, it's almost like they've got to feel like they got to put the brakes on themselves on now. They don't have the excuse of the Republicans slowing things down a little bit. But it is amazing to me that we're on the verge of potentially passing $4 trillion of new spending. I mean,
everybody just shrugs.
And one of the things is, you know, it feels like maybe I'm projecting this on the Democrats, but they don't want to trumpet this too much because frankly, they don't want Kristen Sinema to have a watershed in which to be in opposition to.
Well, I know from talking to progressive Democrats in Congress that is definitely on their mind. And that actually then fuels kind of some of the like alt-left hostility that you see, because you've got people in Congress who are just like, we're going to tack $4 trillion in spending onto this $2 trillion that we just did. We're going to extend the child tax credit through 2025. We're going to do
universal pre-K,
hundreds of
daycare.
Billions in climate money. And in fact, like during that, if you remember during the $2,000, $1,400 kerfuffle, the progressive Democrats were pretty quiet because what they had done, I might have the numbers slightly off, but if when they did $1,400 for every person, that also included kids.
It included dependents, which had not been in the first.
Had not been the case before. Yes. So you have a bunch of people on Twitter who are like, people are so angry they didn't get their $2,000. You're like, didn't get their $2,000. What are you talking about? They got $5,600.
Yes.
Like a family of four.
Yes.
Got a check for $5,600. And if they're online, they're like, why am I supposed to be mad that I didn't get a check for $2,000? I'd be furious if I got a check for $2,000.
Exactly.
I got a check for $5,000. And Democrats didn't, like the progressive Democrats didn't want to fight back against the like online meme and be like, guys,
we're making,
it's not 2000, it's 5,600.
It also, adult dependents also got paid. Yep.
Adult dependents. For just two people in a household, it's 2,800. And that's on top of the 600 that Trump had given back in December. So you do have this weird situation where they don't want to trigger, Sinema and Manchin. Manchin and Sinema don't want to be triggered because they're actually, they don't care either. Like as long as there's no political blowback to them, what do they care?
Well, I mean, that's why, we were joking before we started to record, Sinema is going to come out with the, I demand it be $3.49 right. trillion, dollars, not 3. And, she will
cut $1 billion from it.
Exactly. And that would almost suffice on some level. I mean, it really, at this point, the value, and I go back to when the bipartisan, the Sinema Portman crew first came out with their idea of doing $1 trillion. This is after the Republicans had showed up. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like on that day, Bernie Sanders came out and announced, I want $6 trillion. Mm-hmm. And that was, it seemed like it was exclusively for the opportunity for Manchin and Sinema to say, like, we squeezed Bernie down to $3.5
trillion. Yes. Right.
I mean, it really felt like that. And it's the
3.5 plus the bipartisan one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it felt like there was, a small lesson learned from the Obama years. There was times like you'll remember this. The online left would say, maybe we should come out and pretend we're against the 55-year-old buy-in to Medicare.
Yes,
so that Joe Lieberman can.
So Joe Lieberman is for it. Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is. There's a fascinating dynamic going on. The Republicans seem to be running in a cultural election. And the Democrats are just left alone on the playing field to push all these priorities, short of some of the golden chalice ones for progressives. But at least, from like your normie Democrat, this is a super progressive style of Democrat. I mean, this is a big, big bill. All right. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the eviction moratorium. It is a win for the left that came almost around the time where there was a loss for the left in Ohio. We'll talk about that in just a moment. We'll be right back with Ryan Grimm. So, Ryan, in the last segment, we were talking about, obviously, the sharp rise in the number of Delta infections and the implications that it's having on increases in vaccines and mea culpas by some Republicans who don't feel like they have too much of a Republican electoral future anyways, that they can actually govern. And then we were talking about this very odd moment where we have two infrastructure bills that are going in parallel. One is the so-called bipartisan one, and the other is a reconciliation bill. And it's $4 trillion of new spending. It is our combined ages together. We haven't seen something this big in this country. Maybe together we reach Medicare. But,
you'd have to stretch to there. Yeah.
But nevertheless, it's a big deal. And it's, it's just, it's like they're naming a post office, essentially. Let's see if they can get it done before vacation. But there was something that went down this week that was, I'm not sure how you would characterize it, but this is the eviction moratorium that was announced by the CDC in a state of emergency, ostensibly to protect people from getting COVID, expired. And this was a month out from a Supreme Court ruling where Brett Kavanaugh, people seem to think that he was the only person who, you know, was in favor of extending it, but had written something that was essentially in a concurrence, wasn't even the holding decision, a concurrence that suggested he would have voted against the constitutionality of this if it wasn't ending a month later. He wrote this in June, which is a very odd stance to take for someone who presumes to, I mean, that is a, you know, it's like a critical legal theory ruling. Like, I'm going to look at the implications of this. It's going to create all sorts of havoc and it's going to end anyways. So I don't need to. But if it wasn't, it would be unconstitutional. That's a very weird constitutional yes. principle. But nobody seemed to do anything. And then it expired. Cori Bush, some of the squad, made a lot of noise about it. Cori Bush slept on the steps of the Capitol. And essentially, we saw a reversal. I mean, give us a sense of what went on there. I mean, is it that simply just like the left made a big enough noise? And
I think so, in this sense, that I think that Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, Democratic leaders in general were quite comfortable to just let this go, to say, you know what, we're like enough. Like, we're hearing from landlords, housing prices are up, rents are up. People are blaming, maybe people trying to blame the moratorium. More importantly, we're hearing from landlords. We haven't heard a whole lot from any tenant organizing lobby. So if all we have to do is do nothing, there probably won't be a big stink about it. Let's just let it ride. And so then they have this like pathetic, like back and forth of Biden being calling the CDC on like the day it's expiring to see if they can do it. And then they say, oh, we can't do it. And then he tells Pelosi she's got to do it. And she tells him he's got to do it. And then they just let it go. And I think that they were fine to take their lumps for a day and be done with it. Because you know, they had passed this unwieldy $46.5 billion in rent relief that hadn't gone out the door. So they're like, you know what? This has been a headache. Let's just screw it. But then there's so much, you know, because of Cori Bush and then others going down to the Capitol, they create so much attention on it that they just felt politically jammed in and had to find a way to resolve it.
It's fascinating.
And there was no intellectual basis to their claim that they couldn't do it, like you said.
Well, the interesting thing here is that, you know, Kavanaugh had said this has got to be done legislatively. And at that point, you would imagine the White House would say to Pelosi, you got to do this. It's unclear to me why, you know, Pelosi or even like the squad didn't say like, hey, wait a second, we got to do this.
But also what's weird is, as some people pointed out, it was done legislatively, like by enacting the $46.5 billion to operate in tandem with the CDC's eviction moratorium, specifically in tandem with the moratorium. That is ratifying in statute the CDC's things. So Kavanaugh's claim was just kind of silly. It's like, well, wait a minute, we did put it in law. Where do you think the $46.5 billion came from?
Right. We didn't just make that number up. It was because there was a eviction moratorium.
Right. Which by doing that, you ratify it in statute.
There was reporting last weekend that White House advisors wanted to go ahead with it. But White House lawyers said, well, if you do that, you're going to piss off Brett Kavanaugh. He's going to find other things that are unconstitutional. The only thing that makes me believe that dynamic was there still, obviously they could make a choice to say like, okay, so what? I mean, because the idea was we're going to extend it for 60 days. That will get that money. We'll figure out a way to get that money out the door. We haven't figured it out yet.
We'll believe it when we see it, but
exactly.
Yeah.
But, and that's ultimately what they've done, right? I mean, Biden comes out, we're going to extend it 60 days. He claimed something like, well, I had to let that one end and start a new one. Because of the circumstances of Delta. The other thing that I see that they're doing, Jeff Stein in the Washington Post had a piece on Thursday that was a sort of a TikTok on how they came to this decision. And apparently they called Lawrence Tribe. And Lawrence Tribe said that, oh, no, it's constitutional. And that was the justification. And it is almost as if they are, I mean, because I don't know who that is for, except for, like, Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
I mean, and basically say, like, we're not sticking our fingers in your, we're not poking you in the face. Like, we did have an expert say this, which, you know, it's all well and good. I mean, it's just total kabuki theater, it seems like. But it's fascinating to me that they feel like they've got to play this type of kabuki theater with.
And they took pains to make it a different moratorium. It's like, okay, Brett, this one's illegal. This one is only in places where there's, you know, a problem with COVID.
Right.
And because there's basically a problem with COVID basically everywhere, then it applies to 90%+ of the country. And so you get essentially, you know, more or less the same, well, not more, but less the same moratorium. And you, right. And Brett Kavanaugh feels better.
Respect to Brett Kavanaugh. It is, I mean, this is just, it's a bizarre interplay, but it is what it is.
They should attach impeachment of Brett Kavanaugh to it and see, go the other direction.
Exactly. All right. Listen, we have about 2 minutes left. Let's talk about Ohio 11th. Nina Turner was up big months ago. She is an icon of the Bernie Sanders left, progressive Democrat. She faced an onslaught of money in the last 2 weeks or 4 weeks of the campaign, no doubt about it, from the outside. But they were launching attack ads that had a little more stickiness than those same ads against Jamal Bowman when he ran against Engel and Ilhan Omar. What do you think the lesson is, or is there one, of that race?
Well, right. So the ads against Bowman and Bush and Omar kind of backfired for the most part. They made mistakes by attacking them for, you know, economic and financial problems that they'd had in the past, that blew up in their face. With Nina Turner, they had a couple things that just really stuck, like dissing Hillary Clinton among the, like, Hillary loving voters there, and calling, you know, voting for Biden eating a bowl of crap. Like, that quote was absolutely everywhere. And with $2+ million in super PAC money pumped into the district so that everybody saw that quote, that was enough to erase the gap. But in these low turnout elections, just a few thousand votes moved. She lost by 4,000 votes. There's a fascinating analysis out there that there was this grassroots organizing effort in heavily Jewish neighborhoods that where turnout was double or triple what it was in the rest of the district, and went like 4-1. For Chantel Brown. And I think the flare up in April in Israel, the war there that broke out, contributed heavily to that. The whole argument being made by organizers there was, here comes another squad member, we got to stop her.
Right.
And she and Brown netted 5,000 votes in those neighborhoods. That is the difference. That's the margin. So everywhere else they tied, and she netted five. If there's a turnout of 100,000 to 200,000 in a normal primary, that gets washed out. But in a low turnout, you can pull something like that off. So,
well,
some impressive organizing.
May see Nina Turner give it another try in November.
It's going to be redistricted, though. And there will be more wealthy white neighborhoods thrown into it. And her base will probably be drawn out of it.
Well, Ryan Grimm of The Intercept, thanks so much for spending some time and looking back on this week with us. Really appreciate
it. Always good to be here.
Kyrsten Sinema, Arizona's freshman senator, has made quite the name for herself as one of the two most vocal Democratic obstructionists of President Joe Biden's agenda. Now, centrist politics are nothing new to Washington, but her political career, her motivations, how she got here, they're anything but cookie cutter. Here to talk about his great, extensive piece on Sinema's background is Tim Murphy, senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, people might be surprised by the fact that Sinema was once a Green Party activist, given her record thus far in the Senate. Talk about her background, growing up, her political roots, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I think she comes from a place, at least early in her political career and in her childhood, that's very different from where she is right now, and was at one point very like formative for her political identity. She grew up sort of homeless after her, you know, her father lost his job and moved with her family to the Florida Panhandle, and they lived in like a converted gas station for a while. When she was young, subsisting on donations from the Mormon church, she was raised LDS, skipped two grades in high school, skipped two grades in college. And by the age of 22, she was, by the age of 18, she was in Arizona working as a social worker. And that was very much an essential part of her identity early on. When she got involved in local politics, as you said, as a member of the Green Party and as an independent, you know, she was at the state capitol lobbying for more funding for social services. You know, she was out in the streets protesting the Iraq war. She really saw her work as a social worker, you know, in sort of promoting conflict mediation and working with like undocumented families as an impetus to get more active in politics. And so when she starts off in Arizona, she's very progressive, almost beyond that, almost on kind of the fringe of local politics, running twice for local office before joining the Democratic Party. She ran as a member of the Green Party and as an independent. And it's so only once she enters the Arizona legislature that she begins to kind of start to change her politics.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredibly fascinating. Given the fact that she, her most viral moment from her time in the Senate is her enthusiastically downvoting a $15 minimum wage, that is something that I think is hard to grapple with, especially given the fact that she seemed motivated, at least from her actions at the beginning of her career as a social worker and as a Green Party activist, by her desire, I guess, to benefit working people. But that seemed to change over time, which is interesting because you had these really fascinating anecdotes about how she was hard to pin down and how people who grew up with her, who worked with her, they called her, quote, a very talented actor in the play that she was in, et cetera. One of the people you interviewed remembered her describing herself as a libertarian. So the only thing I kind of can glean from her career and or as a whole, right, even leading up to this point, is that she relished in being an iconoclast, I guess. Is that a through line that you think makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think she really prizes her own individuality. And you can just sort of see that by looking at Kyrsten Sinema, who, you know, very much doesn't, you know, dress like Mitt Romney. You know, she's always been very much her, you know, her own sort of unique personality. And she's also kind of constantly evolving and, like, I would say self-improving. That's a big part of her identity. As I said, she skipped two grades in high school and two grades in college and was just, you know, professional at age of 18. She's since gone back and gotten a number of more advanced degrees. I mean, she's almost always getting some new, you know, MBA or PhD or something like that. She's written a book on the Rwandan genocide. So, you know, she started off as this child prodigy, and it's just kind of throughout her life, you know, she's a top triathlete, you know, throughout her life is constantly adding these like new challenges and sort of these new identities, I suppose, to what she's doing politically.
So then talk about that Green Party activism and anti-war activism, right? Because in the early 2000s, she, like many young people in that time, was motivated to get involved in politics after 9/11. And she seemed to, you know, be quite vitriolically opposed to the wars. Give us a sense of that part of her life.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of rub on her today that she's very much an opportunist. And that's a kind of rebuttal to that in a way, because opportunists really were not getting involved with the Green Party in 2000. She was a real true believer to that cause. She talked a lot back then about sustainability. She talked about, for instance, minimum wage, healthcare access for everybody. She was still, you know, very young. She was working as a social worker. And she really threw herself into the anti-war cause. It was kind of a doomed effort, especially in a place like Arizona at that time. But she took on a leadership role with a group of local activists, kind of a real hodgepodge coalition of, you know, you have your libertarians and you have your Quakers and you have like real hardcore anarchists and cinema, showing a little bit of the cinema that you see today, managed to sort of put it upon herself to bring together these disparate factions and try to get them to work together toward what she viewed as the common agenda. You know, they didn't agree on a lot, but they agreed that the war was bad. So she would, for instance, bring the anarchists and the peace activists together at a local meeting spot to come up with an appropriate protest tactic that would satisfy the nonviolence faction and the Black Bloc. So she was very active in sort of the fringe of local politics at that point. But those experiences also sort of soured her on what it was like to work with the left and what it was like to work with progressives, for instance,
right,
because she found it very not fulfilling.
Well, I mean, I've interviewed Green Party activists before. I've experienced some of the activist left, and sometimes there are cranks. Like, there are people who are odd and difficult to deal with and motivated by passion. And so, but at the same time, you have to, in my view, if you're ideologically aligned, you have to have an understanding that this is the messiness of activism, especially when you're on the fringes like that. So that's an interesting takeaway, which I think I want to come back to at some point. But I do want to now zero in on her two campaign, or her city council campaign, and then she ran, I guess, for state legislature twice and was successful on the second try. I guess let's just first start with that city council campaign.
Yeah, I mean, and she ran for that as a Green Party member, and that was in 2001. The election is actually on September 11th, 2001.
And wow,
by the
really?
Point that wow. came around, and she was, I think, maybe second to last in a very deep field, did not get very many votes. And it's sort of, you know, by the time that rolled around, she had her focus elsewhere. For instance, she was acting in a local community theater production. And, you know, talking to people who were involved with the theater production was sort of interesting. It's a, you know, it's a local play for a Jewish community theater about circumcision. It's like an intergenerational saga. And she plays like a young mother. And the heart of the drama, and the reason she was really interested in the role, was about sort of her grappling, her character grappling with the rules of society. And cinema came at this from the perspective of feeling it like people, you know, who just felt bound up by the rules were kind of betraying themselves, that you need to be comfortable, you know, rejecting things like that you feel unfair and constricting, and living your own life. And at that point in her life, that was sort of how she approached politics. Like, you know, she existed outside of the conventional boundaries of that and was sort of raging against the machine a little bit. 2002, when she runs for state representative, you know, she's still on the outside. She's an independent. She has a bit more institutional backing, as, you know, sometimes happens with down ballot races. But in the end, she comes up short again. And this time she blames the local Democratic Party, which she says, and I don't mean to, you know, throw skepticism on this, but, you know, it's in her characterization, they put out mailers saying that she was too extreme for Central Phoenix, which is sort of a funny concept. You know, Arizona in the early 2000s wasn't exactly Berkeley. But, you know, that was a lesson. You know, she was 0-for-2 now working outside of the party system. And so the next time when she runs again for her third bid for office, she's a Democrat, she wins, and she finally has her foot in the door.
And before, I guess, that victory, there was another, not anecdote or story that you told, about her response to Joe Lieberman, who came to Arizona during his presidential campaign in 2003, which I thought was really instructive and interesting, because she's playing a Joe Lieberman role right now in the Senate, and she had some words for him, which is just really fascinating to me. Do you mind telling that to the audience?
Yeah. She was a real leader, you know, real bullhorn character with her local anti-war group. You know, one of the things that they did was they were leading protests of public officials who supported the Iraq War, leading protests against John McCain, John Kyle, and Joe Lieberman comes to Arizona in 2003 while he's running for president. And Sinema, you know, they organized this caravan to meet him in Tucson and protest him. And Sinema's quoted in an article in the Hartford Courant. And she's just she just doesn't understand his whole tactic of trying to bring Republicans on board. It seems like he's only trying to win Republican votes. And for a long time, this was Sinema's attitude to Joe Lieberman. You know, even years later, as a member of the Arizona legislature, after she's sort of moderated her positions a little bit, she's still, you know, going to town hall meetings and complaining about Joe Lieberman and the kind of Joe Lieberman mindset that just views, you know, bipartisanship for bipartisanship's sake as this empty gesture that isn't going to move you forward.
I mean, talk about some sort of storybook irony there. That is just something I'm immensely fascinated by the psychology behind that, but I'm not going to speculate. I just, people should read your full piece. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk about her victory in 2004 for the state legislature, how she got herself on the national stage, and then, of course, moved towards running for the Senate. We'll be right back. So on her second try, Sinema to run for public office in 2004, she won as a Democrat for the state legislature. Is that really what worked differently than, you know, she ran as an independent before, Green Party for the city council? She seemed to learn some lessons from this. My number one lesson I would take away is, yeah, it's really hard to win as a third party candidate, and you should probably work within the two-party system right now. How did she get there, and what were some of the lessons that she took from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just joining the party was a acknowledgement that what she was doing before wasn't working. And then by the same token, she has since at this point gone on to law school and gotten her law degree. And that also is an acknowledgement that working as a social worker to her was, well, it was good work. It wasn't accomplishing the kind of change and structural change that she wanted to see. She complains about this. She writes about this in her book. You know, she just felt really frustrated by like how little she was getting done. And a through line of her career is her pushing back against the feeling of irrelevance and changing her own circumstances and changing her own politics sometimes to sort of go against that. So she's changed a couple of different careers at around the same time and joins the legislature, but she's still kind of this early version Sinema 1.0. And so for her first year or so in the legislature, she feels again very irrelevant. She feels like she's like very right, but just not getting anything done, that she's giving lots of floor speeches and kind of owning her, you know, Republican colleagues when she does that, but she's outvoted, she's in the minority, she's in a backbencher. So it's this experience in kind of the first half of her first term as a state rep that gets her into this very deliberate reinvention into somebody practicing kind of radical acceptance of her Republican colleagues, devoted to working across the aisle and making friends.
And then she seemed to find her footing by getting this issue of same-sex marriage to be her launching point onto, you know, she was then discussed on national television, and this was a big boon for her career. Talk about that as a strategy, and, you know, what happened during that fight for Sinema.
Yeah, this is really the moment where everything really shifts for her. It's a real revelation in her political philosophy. In 2006, you know, everywhere Republicans, conservatives are pushing same-sex marriage bans to put them in the state constitutions. And they're just racking up dozens of victories, and gay marriage supporters are powerless to stop this. And it cuts to Arizona. Sinema, who is at the point openly bisexual, is takes a lead role in trying to come up with a way to stop this. And it's an open debate among supporters of same-sex marriage at that time, you know, whether trying to stop it is even really the point. You know, if it's inevitable, if this thing's going to pass, maybe you should spend your time educating voters, trying to build a longer term path towards success, you know, changing hearts and minds. And she doesn't want to do that. She looks at the numbers, she looks at the focus groups and the polling, and realizes that she might be able to win this thing if she doesn't really talk about gay marriage. And so they run against this same-sex marriage ban largely by talking about the effects on heterosexual couples, senior citizens. Al and Maxine, I think, is like their prototype for the ad campaign, who would be affected under the repeal of the state's domestic partnership law. They just want hospital visitation rights and access to each other's checking accounts and things like that. And they win. They win a narrow victory. It's the only gay marriage ban, maybe ever, but at least at that time period, to actually lose at the ballot. And so for her, this is a real revelation. She's less focused on sort of purity and looking at the end result here, which is a victory for her and her cause. But then 2 years later, the same supporters of the gay marriage ban come back and it passes. So there's sort of two different lessons that you could take from this. One is that, you know, her strategy worked, and the other was that it didn't really accomplish anything lasting. But she's very much gone all in on the first.
Right. I mean, the strategy of framing it as something that would hurt straight people, probably not politics that have any staying power. But for her, you know, it seems like she really got a taste for winning in this moment, or, you know, not really about, I guess, the method, but the end result, as you say. And this is kind of when things took off for her, and she was portrayed nationally as a liberal hero for the cause, as you write, but conservative talk radio, TV shows were pretty outraged by her, which is very different, I guess, in terms of how she's perceived now. So let's just now move to her congressional campaign, where in 2012, she's I think that was when she was elected to the House of Representatives. Just talk about how she got to that point.
Yeah. I mean, from working off the gay marriage referendum, you know, she gradually kind of starts to lean into this pragmatist brand, you know, over time. She's still, especially by Arizona standards, you know, a progressive almost icon in Arizona. You know, she's working to, you know, fight publicly against things like SB 1070, but she's also taking stances that are starting to alienate some people back home. For instance, when Russell Pierce, the author of SB 1070, the racial profiling law, is challenged in a recall election, Sinema sits it out because they're now friends. She wants to be able to have a working relationship with this really extreme Republican. But Pierce loses, and he's sort of previewing, you know, the ways in which organizers and Mexican-American organizers in Arizona are building this political power to just kind of take power and defeat people like Pierce rather than just working with him. So Sinema is starting to really diverge from the tradition that she comes out of, but still also finding success. So in 2012, with redistricting, she lands on a seat that I think is slightly Republican. And Republicans attempt to use all of this massive, you know, volumes of opposition research against her, stemming largely from her career as an activist, wearing a tutu at an Iraq war demonstration, going to Miami to protest a free trade deal, along with a group of activists known as the Pagan Circle. You know, voluminous writings, including an interview in which she kind of describes herself half jokingly as a Prada socialist. There's just a lot of stuff that gets thrown at her. But one of Sinema's gifts is, and it's sort of been with her, you know, throughout this time, is just that she's able to deflect all of this. I mean, there's nothing particularly scary about, you know, being a Prada socialist. It's kind of a joke almost about yourself. And so you know, a lot of the people going after her on the right don't really realize how flimsy a lot of their attacks are, and she fends it off and she gets elected. And from almost that point on in Washington, she's a different kind of politician even than she'd been in Arizona, and really leans into this role as sort of the bipartisan, almost centrist dealmaker.
So when she was in the state legislature in Arizona, was she as, I mean, she's now, there's leaked speeches of her speaking to the Chamber of Commerce in Arizona. Like, was that part of her political identity and agenda then, to be pro-business and more fiscally conservative? Because a lot of what she made her name on nationally seems to be, you know, issues revolving surrounding gay marriage and other things that I don't know if she'd be against. I would imagine she'd be for as senator now, but clearly she has some interest to protect on the money side.
Yeah, no, it was much different. And I think a big part of this, and it's been mentioned in a number of places, is that for the entirety of her career up until this year, she's always been in the legislative minority. So her role as a Democratic legislator in 2007 is not, you know, big business or the Chamber of Commerce needs a seat at the table and they're going to a Democrat. Her role, and she had a reasonable amount of success with it, was just trying to kind of steer the legislature in a slightly less bad direction. And that has, you know, informed a lot of her approach to politics. And one of the criticisms from activists back home is that she hasn't recalibrated at all now that she finally has power. But yeah, I mean, once she gets to Washington, I think that aspect of her politics takes on, you know, becomes much more pronounced. It's much less about that kind of social worker ethos. It's less about, you know, fighting for undocumented residents or pushing for the $15 wage. And it is, you know, even if you look at her public statements, not just, you know, the leaked video, it is much more rooted in, like, you know, what's good for the Chamber of Commerce is good for us.
Right. It's an incredible transition. And I guess, you know, while we're here, let's go to her Senate campaign. I mean, did she really seem to lean into that identity that she cultivated in Washington as the bipartisan dealmaker, seemingly trying to be in the vein of the maverick type that John McCain so effectively kind of branded in that state? Was that really her blueprint? Especially fascinating given her history of activism in the early part of the 21st century related to the wars and everything there. Is that really the biggest through line of that campaign?
I mean, I think it is. It's a very clear one. And she very much had a sense of what her ideal, you know, her median voter was. And it was, you know, a kind of suburban white woman. She was running a campaign aimed at people like Cindy McCain or Jeff Flake and this not insignificant faction of, you know, independents and people who have voted for Republicans in the past, whose votes were essential to push, you know, the race over into the Democratic column. But also in order to, and she very overtly said that, you know, my idols, you know, I look up to people like John McCain and even Barry Goldwater. But at the same time, you know, her race isn't possible without just the work of changing the state's entire political landscape that was done by, you know, Mexican-American organizers in Arizona and who already had success in pushing for things like, you know, a minimum wage increase and knocking out nativist candidates.
But what's their, and what's their kind of response to her, right? I mean, there must be some kind of betrayal percolating there.
Oh, there absolutely is. And you're starting to see lots of protests outside of her office. You saw, Jesse Jackson and William Barber were arrested at one of her offices earlier this week. I think a lot of the activists who did a lot of work to get her elected are sort of at wit's end about how to change her mind and are still a long way out, you know, from a potential primary challenge or even having somebody in the mix for that. But very much do feel like they've been betrayed and all that work was kind of for naught.
Right. I mean, I remember maybe a few months ago, reading reports from a local paper there that left groups in Arizona, you know, rights groups, to are having a hard time getting a hold of her office, which is, I think, very much in keeping with a lot of this this progression or this change and evolution of her politics that you've documented. I'm at a loss for how to change her mind. Honestly, I've been vocal about my opinions on the filibuster, amongst many things. But I really appreciate your time, Tim. People should read your work over at Mother Jones. Tim Murphy, senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. His profile on cinema is really just excellent. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
On behalf of Ryan Grimm, filling in for Heather Parton, and my colleague Emma Vigeland, thanks so much for listening. Hope to have you listen again soon. Don't forget, become a member, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks.